We welcome you again to Past Impressions on the Mormon Channel. This is a program where we deal with the issues associated with the history of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints and examine some of the prominent people and personalities and significant events associated with those foundational events. I'm Brent Topp, your host, chair of the Department of Church History and Doctrine at Brigham Young University. And joining me again on this episode is Brother Larry Morris, senior editor in the Joseph Smith Papers Project in the Church History Department, and Professor Alex Baugh of the Church History and Doctrine Department at Brigham Young University. Well, brethren, thank you again for joining me on this this program as we examine this very important figure, Oliver Cowdery.
Thank you. Good to be here.
In our last episode, we talked about Oliver's being led by the Lord to be in the life of the prophet Joseph Smith to help with the translation and to be a witness, and a witness not only of the translation process, but a witness of angelic ministrance with the restoration of the Aaronic and Melchizedek priesthood, as a witness and as one of the three witnesses. Let's also finish up talking a little bit about his role in actually bringing about the publication of the Book of Mormon. We ended our last program with talking about Oliver preparing the printer's manuscript. He's been involved in translation, but now he's also preparing the printer's manuscript. Alex, take us through as to how we get from Oliver delivering that to having a actual copy, in fact, 5,000 copies of that Book of Mormon.
Well, as the translation process was going on, Joseph clearly recognized there would be a need to provide another copy. We didn't want to have a Martin Harris incident again where we lost the main manuscript. So immediately after the translation was completed, Joseph instructed Oliver to move ahead with a printer's copy, to make a copy to give to the printer. Now, in the meantime, they were able to secure the services of E.B. Grandin. A contract was struck in August of 1829. I believe it was the 25th of August. And immediately, the process of publication went into high gear. But again, that meant Oliver has to provide another handwritten text for the printer. And he did the very best he could to – can you imagine writing the entire Book of Mormon mm-hmm. out again? That printer's copy is in the possession of the Community of Christ.
Yeah, I think we've all seen it, and
it's a wonderful
document.
It
in our own hands. Yeah,
we wish we had all the original manuscript, but the printer's copy is certainly a wonderful document of the restoration. Well, nonetheless, Oliver moved forward as quickly as he could, and we could. Royal Skousen down at BYU has done most of the work on this, but that printer's copy is primarily in the handwriting of Oliver. There is about 15% or so in the handwriting of which one was it, Larry? Was it
Hiram Smith?
Hiram, and then probably the other small portion maybe in Martin's hands. So those are the three men visiting, negotiating, and working in the E.B. Grandin print shop to get the book printed. Oliver, Hiram Smith, and Martin Harris. Joseph remains down in Harmony. He kind of stays clear. Wherever Joseph goes, of course, controversy follows sometimes. And so he leaves it up to those three men to really spearhead the project of publication. And it moves forward. And I mean, it's just amazing how quickly that process got underway, done and completed. And there were some radar blips as well. I mean, they didn't all go smoothly. But the Wayne County Sentinel, the Book of Mormon, the first copies are ready by March 30th, 1830. So from August to March, that process is well underway and books are produced.
Wow.
So there's a lot of copying and a lot of proofreading to do. And you said it was ready by the end of March. Isn't it amazing that as soon as the Book of Mormon was published, the church was organized, yeah. April 6th.
Yeah. Let's talk about that event, because of that April 6th, 1830 event and what we know based on Doctrine and Covenants, Section 20 of the Articles and Covenants. What is meant by Oliver being the second elder? Some have suggested that Oliver was kind of co-founder of the church. How does that fit into this concept of second elder, and what role does Oliver play with that April 6, 1830 founding of the church and the events subsequent?
Well, I think it's fair to call him a co-founder of the church. He was present for the translation of the Book of Mormon. He was present for the restoration of the Aaronic priesthood and the Melchizedek priesthood, and he was present with David Whitmer and Martin Harris for the experience of the three witnesses. Then he took one of the main roles in publishing the Book of Mormon. Mm-hmm. So he was crucial.
Yeah. I think we could also say that he, Section 20, the Articles and Covenants, which really is the constitutional foundational document of the church, I think we could say he had a hand in that, Larry and
Brent. Definitely.
Joseph's the, you know, seer and revelator, but Oliver has input, and he's you could almost put him as co-author of that document, and yes. It's a masterpiece.
Well, and it wasn't necessarily a revelation given on April 6, 1830.
Right.
This has been in preparation both before and after that event.
And it was a working document,
yeah.
and now dated in the Book of Commandments and Revelations as, I believe, April 10th. So it was primarily done by the time of the organizational meeting. So Oliver has a heavy hand in that as they are now preparing for that April 6th meeting, which both Oliver and Joseph preside at, because Oliver is Joseph's right-hand guy.
Yeah, he's referred to as the second elder. You're listening to Past Impressions with the Mormon Channel. I'm Brent Topp, your host, and with me today are Professor Alex Baugh and Larry Morris from the Church History Department in Salt Lake City. Well, brethren, we've talked about Oliver's role in helping the prophet Joseph Smith bring the Book of Mormon to publication, and also with the establishment of the church in April of 1830. Let's talk now about Oliver's roles from that founding of the church on April 6, 1830, during the period of 1830 to 1836. What do we know about Oliver, what he's doing during those periods of time? Larry, why don't you start us off in talking about what Oliver does?
To me, one of the most significant things he does is leave on a mission in October of 1830. He was called with Parley P. Pratt, Peter Whitmer Jr., and Ziba Peterson. And the four of them left New York, went over to the Kirtland, Ohio area, where they converted Sidney Rigdon and several members of his congregation. I think it was over 100 people. Parley P. Pratt had been associated with them earlier. And so you had a very significant conversion that took place. And then the four of them, I believe they were eventually joined by Frederick G. Williams, but they went all the way over.
Who had joined the church in Ohio, if I remember
right. I think you're right, yes. They traveled all the way to Kansas, actually. You know, the very edge of the frontier. This was only 25 years after Lewis and Clark. And Parley P. Pratt talks about them walking across the state of Missouri in the dead of winter. And what an ordeal it was. So it really shows their devotion, this journey first to teach in Ohio and then to teach to the Lamanites over in eastern Kansas.
Okay. That's interesting. Alex, tell us about what your perspective on that mission to the Lamanites. Larry's taught us about getting over there to the Kirtland area and the conversion of some of those prominent people that will shape the history of the church, Sidney Rigdon, Frederick G. Williams, Parley P. Pratt, and others. Why is it called a mission to the Lamanites, and what role did Oliver play in that and with the Lamanites, per se?
I tell my students, one of the questions you're going to be asked at the pearly gates is, who's the first mission president? And it's definitely our man, Oliver. But anyway, as Larry mentioned, he was men were directed by revelation to go to what would be today eastern Kansas, but at that time was considered Indian territory, newly set apart for the uncivilized tribes to actually migrate to that area for their tribal lands. The main group they encountered. Actually, two. They spent one short evening in the Indian Territory with the Shawnee Mission. But the main focus of their proselyting activities was the Delaware tribe that had just arrived there a few months earlier. Unfortunately, some political things came into being, and these four missionaries had not received, nor did I think they know, that they needed to receive approval for this mission to actually proselyte to the Indians. And so they were promptly removed. But that at that time, Oliver stays right there in Independence. Parley sent back to try to figure out what's the next program. What do we do? And Parley or Oliver waits there, and Joseph will come down that following summer and designate the land of Zion, and we begin a Mormon colony. What's the word?
Migration. Migration.
There we go.
The settlement of
into western Missouri. Now, that's very important because in the meantime, W.W. Phelps is called to be a printer to the church and to establish the printing operation in Independence. That's where Oliver's at. And Oliver will assist for the next really 2+ years, Larry. He'll assist in the publication of the Book of Commandments and the church's newspaper, the Evening and Morning Star. So that mission really kind of morphed into the role of Oliver now being an editor and a printer into the church, which will really take him through the next 6 years in terms of his editorial and printing skills.
And isn't it interesting that Oliver is one of the first members of the church to reach what became Zion, mm-hmm. Jackson County?
Interesting. Yeah, and so we once again see how the Lord has one stated purpose for the revelation that the saints, the early saints, thought it was, but there were so many other things that come as a result. Just as Zion's camp produced great leaders for the church, the Lamanite mission produces so much that shapes the whole history of the church thereafter. What do we know about Oliver Cowdery and a position that we don't have in the church today of associate president of the church? What does that mean, and what was going on during that that period?
We don't have that position anymore, and it's kind of a assistant to Joseph Smith. I think the closest thing we have now would be a counselor in the first presidency. But Oliver Cowdery was closely involved in the decisions being made and helped lead the church. And, of course, then you have eventually a first presidency mm-hmm. being formed. And I believe the first people that actually were members technically of the first presidency would be Sidney Rigdon and Jesse Gause.
And then subsequently Frederick G. Williams.
That's correct.
And so
that left a void for Oliver. What's his role if we have a first presidency? And in December of 1834, Brent and Larry, the position was actually appointed unto Oliver by revelation. And it, in a sense, I think it I even like to see it as almost co-president mm-hmm. versus a counselor type thing. But he really is kind of the side-by-side man with Joseph Smith.
Well, and we've seen that throughout the whole history there.
Yeah. So this ties in with his receiving the keys with Joseph Smith. And in not only the Aaronic and Melchizedek priesthood, but the Kirtland Temple experience in 1836.
You're listening to Past Impressions. We're talking today with Larry Morris and Alex Baugh about the great contributions of Oliver Cowdery, the second witness of the Restoration. We were talking about his excommunication from the church and disassociation with the saints. So, Larry, tell us a little bit about what was going on. What were the issues associated with that? As Alex has talked about the charges, let's just follow up on how Oliver gets excommunicated.
Well, you know, in Kirtland, there had been severe financial problems, and Oliver had helped raise money for the construction of the Kirtland Temple and had become kind of personally liable for some of those debts. There are a lot of financial things going on. And some of the charges against him when he was excommunicated had to do with financial matters. There were certain elements in Missouri who were a little hypersensitive about persecution, considering all the things they'd been through in the last few years. And certain people like Sidney Rigdon were suspicious of any church members who seemed to be disloyal. So you had that context. And then certain people didn't agree with the ways that Oliver was trying to earn money for his family, you know. And Oliver said when he was excommunicated that his disagreements had to do with the outward government of the church, not the doctrine or the revelations that had been given.
Hmm.
He remained a firm believer in the restoration his entire life.
Well, let's talk about that, because there are those that would contend that Oliver or other witnesses too, when they became angry with Joseph or disassociated with the church, denied their testimony. What do we know about that?
Well, he certainly would not do that and could not do that, and he knew that. And he was more than converted. And I think what happened here, Brent and Larry, too, is he recognizes the action taken against him, but he expects there will be a reconciliation, that in the end things will work out and that he will be, invited back. And he's just kind of holding out until that happens, until he feels like they've come to his side of the story and recognize the situation fully. So he bows out gracefully, quite frankly, and he moves down to Richmond for just a few months. And then his brother, Lyman, it was Lyman, Larry.
Yes.
Yeah, invited him to come and practice law back in Ohio. So he goes back and actually established for a short time back in Kirtland. And then he moves to Tiffin, Ohio, where he really, moves forward with his law practice. Again, all this time, he believes in Joseph Smith. He's not denying the restoration in any sense of the word. He's just waiting for some sort of opportunity to have some sort of reconciliation.
In fact, one of the things that he was worried about, he was afraid that his excommunication would tarnish his reputation as a witness of the Book of Mormon. And he wanted to be careful about how he came back into the church. He didn't want to admit anything that he wasn't guilty of. But he was primarily interested in his reputation as a witness of the Book of Mormon.
Interesting. Was there ever reconciliation with Joseph?
Well, they never did see each other again, but when Joseph was in Carthage jail, the day he died, a letter was received from Oliver Cowdery, and there's certainly evidence to assume that it was some type of reconciliation, but unfortunately we don't have that letter.
Hmm.
And beginning in 1842, overtures were being made. Oliver, we want you back. You need to come back. We'll make that happen. We'll help you in that regard. And so that's also that letter that Larry mentions. There's encouragement for Oliver to step back into the church. So things are starting to move forward.
Larry, you mentioned that Oliver was very, very concerned about his reputation and the how people would perceive him as a witness of the restoration and of the Book of Mormon particularly. Why don't you tell us about how he bore his testimony at a trial and how that came about?
Well, that's a good topic to talk about. You know, there is certainly the story has been told of Oliver bearing his testimony at a trial, but we really don't have solid evidence for that.
Hmm.
When you take the details of the accounts that are given, they don't match up.
That's right.
With the details that we know where he was and what he was doing at certain times. So we haven't been able to substantiate that story. But in his letters, he was certainly bearing testimony.
Okay.
Now, it comes through is his letters.
It's an apocryphal story that we love to have there of his testimony. But in reality, it's the event may not have happened, but the testimony was strong nonetheless.
No question. Yeah.
Well, tell us about how he got back to the church. I mean, you mentioned that in 1842, as early as 1842, there's some overtures. Larry, you mentioned the letter that was received at Carthage. When does he come back to the church, and under what circumstances?
The key player here is Phineas Young, the brother of Brigham Young. Phineas had married Oliver's half-sister, and so he technically was a brother-in-law to Oliver and Elizabeth Cowdery. So he's the one making those overtures, trying to get some connections with Oliver and the church and the church's leadership, and he does a marvelous job. And eventually, Oliver will begin writing and exploring the opportunity to possibly come back. Now, he does stay for a number of years in Tiffin. He rises through the ranks of the Democratic Party. He's a pretty prominent player. He's an excellent lawyer, but he decides to shift and move to Elkhorn again, following Lyman, his brother. So he's getting a little bit closer to the saints, who by this time have begun the exodus and have begun to plan to move west. And Oliver is made aware of that, and all the indication is that Oliver hoped to plan and intended on joining the saints and then moving west with the saints.
When does he get rebaptized, and what do we know about that?
Well, Phineas was there near Council Bluffs when Oliver arrived in 1849, I believe it was. This was before Oliver was rebaptized, but he arrived on the scene just as a conference was being held of all these saints migrating to Utah, and they invited him to come up, and he bore his testimony and said how he had helped Joseph Smith with the Book of Mormon, and then it was translated by the gift and power of God, and he bore a very powerful testimony there at that time. And a few days later, Orson Hyde, whom Oliver had helped select as one of the original members of the 12, baptized Oliver back into the church. Hmm. He was out of the church about 10 years.
Wow. And why does he never make it to Utah, Alex?
Well, he had also made overtures to David Whitmer to actually come up and meet him up in Council of Canesville.
To try to get them to reconcile as well.
Exactly.
With the saints.
Hmm. David did not show up. And Oliver makes the decision, this would be 1848, late 1848, to go down and spend the winter with the Whitmers, who are his in-laws in Richmond, Missouri. They're all there.
Yeah, he's married to David Whitmer's sister.
Yeah. So he goes down there, and unfortunately, he has he has the beginnings of what we begin, as Larry mentioned, tuberculosis. He's very poor. He's not in good health. And unfortunately, all of those factors and some others inhibited him from joining the saints in the West. And he dies in May of 1850 at the home of his father-in-law, Peter Whitmer Sr., in Richmond, Missouri.
March 3rd, if I can correct you.
There we go. Oh, I'm sorry.
1850?
March 3rd.
And let me tell you what David Whitmer said about Oliver's death. He bore testimony of the Book of Mormon. And then David Whitmer said, "He died the happiest man I ever saw, and he said, 'Now I lay me down for the last time. I am going to my Savior.' And he died immediately with a smile on his face."
Wow, what a powerful testimony.
Now sadly, Elizabeth, his wife, never remarried. And they had one daughter. Her name was Maria. She marries a man in 1856 named Charles Johnson, who was a physician. They actually went as far as Colorado for a period of time, but they settled in Southwest City, Missouri. I mean, it's exactly where that describes, the south, most southern west city, little community in Missouri. And she was living with them, and she died in, I believe, 1892. And just a few days later, the daughter dies. So these two, mother-daughter, are buried together, and there were no children. So no posterity of Oliver Cowdery past the daughter, Maria.
Wow. Well, as we've talked about Oliver Cowdery, he may not have any posterity or descendants in the church, in the world today, but his influence in the restoration of the gospel and his influence in the church is felt around the world. Thank you, Alex and Larry, for being with us today to talk about these exciting and interesting things about one of the foundational figures of the restoration of the gospel, Oliver Cowdery.
Thank you very much.
Join us again in a future episode as we talk about past impressions of events associated with the restoration of the gospel of Jesus Christ and the history of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. I'm Brent Topp, your host, and we look forward to having you join us for a future episode.